Welcome, friends. James Corbett here, CorbettReport.com. Today is the 19th of February, 2015, and today we're honored to be joined on the line by Alex Sekiris, the entrepreneur-turned-podcaster behind the Skeptico podcast. That is Skeptico, S-K-E-P-T-I-K-O, at Skeptico.com. Skeptico is science at the tipping point and features all sorts of very interesting conversations on consciousness science, near-death experience, parapsychology, skepticism, spirituality, and other topics. And Alex has just recently released a book, Why Science is Wrong About Almost Everything, that is bound to be as provocative as the title suggests that it is. And having just read it, I can assure you that it is a provocative and very, very interesting book in a lot of different respects. So Alex, thank you for taking the time to talk with us today.
Oh, you bet, James. It's a great pleasure to be on your show, and I'm really looking forward to this dialogue, this give and take, because as you know, I'm a big fan of your show, and your work has really influenced me, and in some ways I hope we can talk about, I think is key to understanding this big issue of science and why it's wrong.
Absolutely. Well, that is a very big issue. So, but I have to be careful not to get too far ahead of myself with this conversation, because we have talked before. I was on Skeptico back a few years ago now, back in episode 167 of Skeptico, and I'll include the link in the show notes if people want to go back and listen to that conversation. But I am already familiar with yourself and your work, but a lot of the listeners in the audience might not be. So why don't we just start by you explaining a little bit about Skeptico and how and why you came to start that podcast?
Well, Skeptico is really a front. It's a front for my exploration of just the big picture questions, I guess you could say in science, but really in life. So I was someone who, like a lot of folks, listened to a lot of interviews, listened to a lot of people that I thought were interesting and I thought were doing some cutting edge work either in science or in spirituality kind of stuff. But I always had more questions. And I thought podcasting would be a great way that I could actually ask these people the questions that I didn't feel like were getting answered. And those mainly surrounded around, again, these big picture things. Who are we? Why are we here? And this debate that I saw brewing between folks on one hand who said, hey, there's all these strange things going on. There's psychic medium communication. There's parapsychology effects. There's maybe even consciousness after death. And then there were all these other people on the other hand, the straight-laced science people who were saying, no, that's impossible. That can't possibly be. So I was coming at things, as you mentioned, I mean, I was really just kind of a business guy, an entrepreneur, had enough time on my hands and interest to dig into it and said, hey, you know, why not me? Why not go just try and answer these questions? So that was the origin of Skeptico. And the name Skeptico is from my ancestry being a Greek American. Skeptikos was the original ancient Greek philosophers who didn't form any firm conclusions, just always questioned everything. So that's been kind of the ethos.
Well, that's interesting in and of itself. And I think we might return to that later on in this conversation, because I wanted to ask you about that. But before we get into this, I mean, there's a couple of different ways we can approach this. And perhaps the best way to start is for the listeners in the audience who might wonder at the surface level here, what the connection between our work might be. You're talking about consciousness science and near-death experience and parapsychology and these types of issues. And here I am talking mostly in the geopolitical realm and things of that nature. Where does our conversation really interconnect here might be a question that a lot of people have on their mind. But we have corresponded on and off over the years, and you've mentioned a few times now that you think there is a real point of correspondence between our work. And let's see if we can identify and hone in on where our work overlaps, or the sort of project that we're both engaged in from very different spheres.
Well, I think there's a couple angles to approach that. One is, you know, I often tell people that my journey was starting out saying, okay, it's about the data, you know? So I have these questions. I need to just go gather the data, and then I'll have the answers. And that I call Skeptico 1.0. So I was out there just talking to researchers, talking to the best people I can find without really a big agenda, and I was gathering data. And I liken that to some of the work that, you know, you've done, but just about everyone who's interested in those geopolitical topics that we all are interested in because they affect our life, that's the first step, is just go out and collect the data. It's about the data. I'll get the sources of information. I'll sift through them and I'll get my answers. For me, then, I got to the point where I realized that it wasn't at all about the data, that there was really another game being played. There was this shell game. There were all these conspiracies, if you will, this misinformation and misdirection, this really bastardization of the scientific method. There were people who were doing, by all accounts, good work, whose work was not advancing and whose ideas would never see the light of day. And worse than that, they were actively being, you know, just bludgeoned into obscurity. And that was what I call Skeptico 2.0. It's not about the data. It's about everything else. It's about the whole thing that's going on around that. And I see a direct parallel with your work. I think anyone would. And that really started, I think, opening me up. It was kind of this relationship where that opened me up to some conspiracy theory investigations. And that in turn changed my perspective in saying, hey, what is really going on with some of these questions we're I'm asking? Why is it that science is telling us that we are meaningless beings in a universe that has no meaning, that when our child is born, the feelings we feel for them, they aren't real. It's all an illusion, that we're just these biological robots. Could there perhaps be some control mechanism behind that? Could there be some agenda to that kind of crazy silliness that just gets perpetuated over and over again? And I guess I'm kind of tipping my hand. I think there is an agenda, and I think it fits in some ways to some of the, you know, and what I love again about your work too, because I think it's the only way you can be, is I don't see you coming to a lot of firm conclusions about what the control mechanisms are, or what the end game is, or what the purpose of some of this misinformation is. You just have to know that what you're being fed is probably not the full-on truth. And that probably will is enough of an introduction to the kind of intersections.
I think so, and I think it does very much raise the specter of what I see as a fundamental point of accord between our work, which is that idea. I really do think that there is an agenda, a political and historical agenda, to plant and sow that seed in the public consciousness that we are biological robots for a very specific political and historical reason. And that does absolutely touch on something that I think is a fundamental part of the geopolitical manipulations that we see. But again, before we get into that, perhaps we should just track back a little bit to your Skeptico 1.0 type investigations and work, because that's the type of thing that a lot of people, just prejudging based on what they hear about this podcast or whatever, will probably, that just sounds like craziness. And in Why Science is Wrong About Almost Everything, you do a great job of highlighting some of the conversations you've had on Skeptico with some of those researchers who have been doing some really, really great and remarkable and very important science that, as you say, is completely and utterly dismissed and ridiculed and marginalized before it's even looked at, really, by a lot of the people who you would think would be able to articulate more precise criticisms of it. There's all sorts of different phenomenon here, psychics and psychic detectives and telepathy and things of this nature that are, again, just completely beyond the pale of science. Perhaps you could, just for the benefit of the audience that is unfamiliar with this work, perhaps you can tell us about one of those that sticks out in your mind as a type of researcher that's been doing some great work that's often neglected.
Well, you know, you mentioned the psychic detective thing, which I know sounds so strange. I would even say probably bizarre to a lot of people. People are probably tuning out right now and go, okay, James, next, you know. That was kind of one of my initial interests, though. Sitting on my couch, watching the Bio Channel on a show on psychic detectives, and going to my wife, you know, saying, gee, I don't know. I can't believe that cop, that New Jersey 20-year detective is flat out lying to the camera when he says, I talked to this psychic. This psychic knew where the body was, drove me there, and help me solve the case. And I was like, you know, come on. I mean, somebody's not telling the truth here. either the detective is making this up or all these people who are saying that's just complete nonsense, they're not really being straight up about it. So one of the investigations I did, and it was a pretty lengthy one, and it's described in the book, is I talked to two detectives who had worked on this serial killer case, a really horrible case, they all are, in New Jersey. And I worked with the psychic medium who helped solve the case, and her name is Nancy Weber. And then I did a co-investigation with a science reporter, very, very skeptical guy, writes for Skeptic magazine, but publishes in some pretty mainstream science publications like Discover News and stuff like that. And this guy's name is Ben Radford. And he agreed, which was nice on his part, to do this joint investigation. And we're both going to interview the detectives, we're both going to interview the psychic, and we're going to see what we could come up with. And I think that was really, as I mentioned in the book, that was one of the turning points for me, because the data, if you will, that we had was just totally clear. I mean, I had the interview transcripts with the captain who said, yes, she told me all this amazing stuff, led us to the body, told us that the killer had moved to Florida, had killed in Florida, and then had been wrongfully released and returned, and all this detail. That was corroborated by the lieutenant who was from a different police department that joined the case. All this was shared with us, and it matched the story that the psychic told us. And then we had to see the just total distortion and lying, there's really no other way to do it, that went into the report from the skeptic, that the skeptic makes and maintains to this day, Ben Radford does, that this is a case that is the best case of how psychic detectives can't work and can't possibly be effective. So I think that's one example of the kind of investigation. Now, you had asked another question, because those kind of personal investigations aren't really what the show is about, and what really isn't what the book is about for the most part. It's really about talking to the best researchers in the country and in the world that I can find. And I've talked to so many of them that I'm really grateful to. So when you talk about psychics, probably the best research being done right now is by a woman named Dr. Julie Beischel, formerly of the University of Arizona, now has an organization, research organization on its own. The Winbridge Institute has published numerous peer-reviewed articles, gets past all the cold reading problems that many people associate with psychic communication, easily controls for that, and has found very significant results suggesting that this kind of anomalous communication, that's what they call it in the parapsychology world, does in fact happen. So there you have the spectrum. You have a case study that I think if anyone would read it or listen to it on Skeptico, it's utterly, utterly, clearly convincing that that what these people said did happen. And then you have the scientific research to back up that by the best means we have in science of investigating something like that, there does seem to be a phenomena there that we cannot explain.
Well, I'm glad that you highlighted that Ben Radford co-investigation, because I do recall, it's been maybe a year or two, but I do recall listening to one of the conversations that you had with Ben, and I believe the detective was in that conversation as well, if I recall correctly. Yes, right. I don't remember the specifics of the case at this point, but I do remember coming away from that conversation with the ironclad conviction that, yes, I mean, Ben Radford was being disingenuous, or in some way just refusing to look at the data. And that was the overwhelming conclusion of that investigation, which was interesting. I mean, again, that doesn't in and of itself mean that this is some sort of proven phenomenon, but it certainly means that the people who should be doing their best to actually investigate this certainly are not. And it is a sort of paradigm shifting thing to encounter that type of closed-mindedness, and perhaps shouldn't be that surprising to listeners of the Corbett Report who encounter it all the time. There are people who will absolutely shut down when you say something like 9/11 was an inside job, in the same way there are people who will absolutely shut down when you say, look at this scientific research about psychics or what have you.
Or reincarnation.
Or reincarnation or near-death experience. Yes.
And, you know, there's another parallel that I think is really interesting. You deal a lot with the phony wars that we've experienced, war on terror, just the phoniness of it and how it's used and in so many different ways to manipulate us and control us and lead us in the wrong direction. I think the net of my work comes down to a similar kind of war, and it's this culture war, and it's this phony culture war of science versus religion. And it's this stuck on stupid debate of a religious dogmatism that is utterly kind of goofy. I can't really pull too many punches there in terms of the doctrine. And we've done a number of shows investigating, you know, if you really pull apart the scriptures that are the basis for Christianity and Judaism and Islam, you know, it doesn't make sense in so many ways. And I think many of your listeners have probably already gone there and done that work. But yet it's pushed forward as that's one side of the debate. And the other side of the debate that's advanced is this idea that science is somehow pulling us through that darkness into the light of truth. And then inside that message of light and truth is this really kind of disastrous idea that we alluded to before, that is, you are meaningless. Hey, after all, do your best and we'll get you through to the light. But at the end of the day, you're a meaningless peon in a meaningless universe. And there isn't anything you can really do that makes a difference. You don't have any moral compass. That's an illusion. You don't have any free will. That's an illusion. And yet all that gets wrapped in a cloak of mystery that, oh, it's not really like that. You know, I just this last week interviewed two people that many of your listeners probably know, Michael Shermer, the very famous skeptic, and Lawrence Krauss. He just did this movie with Richard Dawkins, you know, two famous atheists who are kind of pulling on this. And I asked them both about this morality question and how we could possibly have a morality in a meaningless universe. And they don't have an answer because it doesn't make any sense. If the universe is meaningless, then everything we do is meaningless. And yet you can see, I think I can see, why that agenda might be very useful to someone who's trying to, one, control large masses of people, but number two, keep this system that we've built, this consumeristic, materialistic system going. I mean, that's kind of a good set of beliefs and values to have to just keep that engine running.
Well, this is where I think, again, this intersects with my analysis of the political and historical conditions that brought about the development of this mentality. And I've talked about this in various podcasts I've done before, talking about Darwin is sort of the launching point of this. I'm not sure to the extent that Charles Darwin himself was involved in this, but certainly his legacy has been used for this effect and was immediately picked up on by his cousin, Francis Galton, working in the late 19th century to develop what was really a sort of scientific, if you will, a scientific replacement for the old divine right of kings, which obviously had gone by the wayside by the 19th century. So there needed to be this new ideology for the ruling class. Why do they rule and why do they have the right to rule? And I think all of this that we're talking about here is wrapped up in it. You are a meaningless biological robot. And because of this, it's survival of the fittest. And that's the only meaning to life. And the people who rule you rule because they are the fittest. And all of those kinds of assumptions, I think, become bundled up in that. But you raise another important point in what you're saying there, which is that there's really a lack of nuance to the understanding of this debate. Again, it's framed as this simple one side, other side, in the same way that the political system is framed as the simple left versus right, blue versus red, or what have you. Here we have this science versus religion as this phony debate that they set up where both sides of that debate lead us in the wrong direction. And that implies that there is a subtlety and a nuance to the understanding of this subject that is lost on a lot of people out there, because obviously that is being precluded from the discussion, which brings us to the question of the very provocative title of your book, Why Science is Wrong About Almost Everything. And I think I understand perhaps what you mean by that, but I think a lot of people won't and will be either perhaps tempted to read the book because of it, or completely put off because of it. And let me just quote Rupert Sheldrake here from the foreword of your book, because I think he makes an interesting point in this. He says, "In spite of my appreciation of Alex's investigative skills and his bravery and commitment to truth, I think the title of this book goes too far. Science is not wrong about almost everything. It is right about a great many things, or right enough. Everyone is appropriately impressed by computers, smartphones, the internet, jet planes, hip replacement surgery, antibiotics, solar panels, and many other technological inventions that enrich and sustain our lives. Science is right about the existence of galaxies beyond our own, about the structure of molecules, about the existence of fossils, about low-temperature superconductivity, and many, many other things. What it is seriously wrong about is the nature of life and consciousness. The materialist theory cannot account for the existence of minds, and also, in my view, gives a very inadequate understanding of the nature of life. It would have been better to call this book Why Science is Wrong About Consciousness, or Why Science is Wrong About Life and Consciousness. I told Alex so, but he wanted to stick to his original title. So, Alex, let me ask you, why this title? Why did you defend the use of this title when it is so provocative, and perhaps needlessly so?
I have the highest respect for Dr. Sheldrake, and he's been on my show many times. I often, as this title has come up along with his foreword, which I love, because I love the dialogue, and I love the dialogue that's created by this. But two things. One, first, Dr. Sheldrake is a gentleman who just wrote a book, published a book titled The Science Delusion. So, you know, it's a little bit of a hair splitting, I think, in some ways. But moreover, I do part ways with Dr. Sheldrake in this important point. Number one, the title is somewhat meant to be provocative in this way. Science can't be right or wrong. Science is a process. It's a method. It's not a position statement. This is part of the problem. Science is used to tell us, science says this, science says that. Science can't say anything. It's a frickin' toolbox sitting in the corner. It can be used effectively or it can be used ineffectively. But the fact is, we understand what that title means, whether you agree with it or disagree with it. We understand when we say science is right or science is wrong. And I challenged Rupert on this a couple times, and he wants to say I'm kind of stubborn and not changing my title. He's unbelievably stubborn, but that's what I love about him. And he's a top-notch scientist, Cambridge biologist, published in Nature, top scientist. So I think maybe that's why he's kind of defending that turf. But if, as he admits, science is wrong about consciousness, which means science is wrong about your minute-by-minute experience of who you are. You think you are in there. Something is happening. Something is alive. Science tells you it is not. It tells you that voice inside your head is an illusion. Science is wrong about when you began to be you. Science is wrong about when you will not be you anymore. That is the end of life, end of consciousness. Clearly, the near-death experience science, the more than 100 peer-reviewed papers, clearly show that in some way we don't understand, consciousness survives our bodily death. So I ask you, if science is wrong about your minute-by-minute experience, when it began, when it ends, well then, you know, with all due respect, Dr. Sheldrake, you can pile up all the hip replacements and lasers and all the rest of that stuff you want. I don't think it stacks up to what science is fundamentally wrong about and how much that impacts every aspect of science as we know it. Everything that we investigate, if we are not properly considering how consciousness might factor into it, what that asterisk is at the bottom of our papers, where the part that we don't know, that mystery, then I don't think we have the science that we think we do. So yes, it's provocative, but it's provocative for that point because the dialogue is so skewed the other way. Science is put on this pedestal and is so immune from any kind of attacks in these fundamental ways that I think it's good to take it down a notch. And I'm willing to go toe-to-toe with anyone who wants to defend science in that way.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, that's an interesting answer because I both agree and disagree with various parts of that answer. But I think you're exactly right, of course, that science is not right. It is not wrong. It is a method, is a process of discovery, which is what I think most of the scientifically inclined opponents of this book would say just on hearing the title. Well, science is just a method. But of course, it is absolutely implicitly woven throughout our society that scientists say this or scientists say that, therefore it is true, which of course is not really what science is supposed to be at all. So I think the point that you make there is absolutely apt. And yet it's interesting. Again, there are so many different points to be made here, but the point that you make about science being wrong about our experience of ourself, our consciousness, our what, you know, life is at its most fundamental nature is again, I think, an apt one and one that I do share. I do not think we are biological robots, and I do not share this, the materialist philosophy that says everything is reducible to atoms and molecules. I mean, I think there is something in this universe that cannot be weighed or measured or put in a test tube, and I think that consciousness is something that, again, science really doesn't have any understanding of in the way that people think that it does. But having said that, again, my personal experience of my day-to-day life is not an experience that is focused on near-death experience or parapsychological phenomenon or things of that nature. It is experiencing love and happiness with my family or experiencing, you know, a wonderful day outside and just feeling the sunshine on my face or whatever. And that to that extent, I mean, again, science and the scientific inventions that you say, well, hip replacement surgery or whatever, I wouldn't just say or whatever. I wouldn't throw that away. I think that is an important point of the experience that I actually experience in my daily life. And yes, I think there is that big question of who we are and what we are that is that big underlying phenomenon that needs to be investigated and is not it being properly investigated by science or cannot perhaps be properly investigated by science. But that doesn't dismiss that other aspect of the reality that I experience.
Another parallel between our two worlds, if you will, James, and here it is. I think what you do a marvelous job of is sorting through these misinformations, these intentional misdirections to get at, nudge a little bit closer to the truth. You don't offer up the truth. You just say, this seems to point towards the truth. Then it is up to your listeners to do what they will with that. You know, so if they want to go become violent anarchists and, you know, go out in the street and throw Molotov cocktails, they might do that. If they might just want to vote differently or if they might want to live differently, that's up to them. You're just providing the information. I feel the same way. If someone at the end of the day realizes the reality of consciousness being more than what science as we know it tells us we are, facing the metaphysical craziness of meaningless universe. Think about that for a minute. You know, when I talk to theoretical physicist Lawrence Krauss, he's very confident that we live in a meaningless universe. Where did he get that? That's purely a metaphysical assumption. He didn't get that from experimentation, observation. That isn't derived from spin or gravity or some other physical force. It's a metaphysical assumption. Yet that metaphysical assumption drives so many of these decisions. So when we strip away that and we say, hey, the best evidence suggests that consciousness, in some way we don't understand, survives bodily death. That from University of Virginia, the researchers, top-notch people, published in the best journals, reincarnation, the best explanation for it is, in some way, it does seem to happen. Again, in some way, we don't understand. I can't tell you what to do with that information. I don't know how that's going to inform your life, how that's going to make your life better or worse, how it's going to make you closer to your family or less close to your family, whether it's going to send you to church or running away from church. That's not my job, if you will. Nudging a little bit closer to the truth is my job. Exposing the grand orchestrated misinformation campaign that tells you you're nothing, that you don't really have a say in how things turn out for you, other than in this meaningless way of just living this meaningless life that don't think too much about it, but you know, when you die, you're dead, dust to dust, then, you know, that's where I got it. That's where I live, and that's kind of my job.
Well, that, I guess, raises perhaps my most combative question, but I hope you take it in the light that it's meant, because I am someone who has listened off and on to the Skeptical podcast for years now, and am very much looking forward to your conversation with Michael Shermer, who I really should try to get on the Corbett Report, because that would make an interesting conversation as well. But it strikes me, as someone who has listened to your podcast over the years, that the one of the underlying messages that it seems that you keep putting, usually in contrast to your guests, interestingly, is the idea that the tagline of the podcast, again, is Science at the Tipping Point, which makes it sound like there is this tipping point that's about to be reached, or some sort of critical mass, or some type of paradigm shift. And yet the overwhelming message that I get from your podcast, and perhaps I'm wrong on this, and if so, please correct me, but the overwhelming message is that there is no paradigm shift. There is no change that's taking place. There's no mass waking up. People are not fundamentally changing. Skeptics are not changing their mind. No one is really open to the evidence. And that is such a fundamentally depressing message that it really does leave me with the question, I guess a dual question. Firstly, why do you bother to do the podcast if that's your fundamental belief? And secondly, perhaps more importantly for the listeners, why should they listen to such a podcast?
Well, I do enjoy so much your work, and I think sometimes I see more of these parallels than you do. But gosh, James, isn't there a complete parallel with your work? I mean, are we really going to prevent the new world order that is being ushered in? I guess we could see a mass rising up of people and changing and this and that. But I when I hear that, and I hear people actually kind of operationalize how that might happen and this and that, you just got to kind of chuckle. I mean, that isn't going to happen. I mean, we can nudge things around the edges, and maybe we can make things better, and we don't know how things are going to turn out. Now I'm talking about New World Order. But certainly, I don't think your show or the related shows in the truth movement are really going to, I don't think the quarters of power are, you know, shuddering at the notion that, you know, the next turn is going to come with us rising up, you know, with our podcast, your podcast listeners rising up. Just isn't going to happen. And when you look at the political debates that still rule the day, how do you get up? You know, I could turn it around. How do you get up out of bed when you do all this great work and you expose all this stuff, and then we have to get up and listen to Barack Obama's State of the Union that everyone is tuned into? It's like alternative reality times 10. You know, who is listening to that? Who possibly believes any of that? Yet we know that most of the American public, and I know you're in Japan, but most of the American public does believe it. And when you sit down and try and have that conversation with them, and even try and crack the door open a little bit, even want to talk about JFK, which I have to say, the videos you did on Lee Harvey Oswald, I thought it was one of the best videos out there, just in pulling together a lot of the data on Lee Harvey Oswald and bringing that all in one place. So I'm so into the JFK thing, because that was really the first conspiracy that kind of opened me up in so many ways. So I do appreciate that work. So that's the parallel that I'm at. I'm just, I think sometimes, in contrast to some of my listeners, I'm much more of a realist. Hey, I'd love to see the paradigm change, the consciousness change, the openness to a different understanding of who we are in a more enriched, spiritually without religiously infused understanding. But do I see that happening? No, I don't see that happening. I see the rank and file of the religious fundamentalists who are driven by fear and misinformation, they're not losing any significant strength. And on the other hand, I see the atheists who are peddling their wares, they're gaining numbers and they're gaining strength. So, you know, I mean, I just think we have to be realistic about the state of events. But, you know, whether you get up every day and put your boots on and march forward, that's a different issue. Of course you do. And that why I do that, I think, would get into a lot deeper questions, but I'll turn it around. I mean, why do you continue to do what you do? Is it driven by this belief that there is going to be this uprising, this kind of political shift that would fundamentally change our political structure? Do you believe that's going to happen?
Well, it's not a question of belief of whether or not it's going to happen. It's a belief in the possibility of change, which I absolutely and certainly do. I've said on the podcast a number of times now that if I didn't believe that there was the possibility for genuine change in our situation, I wouldn't be doing this podcast. I would be curled up in a corner in a fetal position or just whatever, getting drunken and just enjoying life and trying to distract myself. I obviously do believe that this work has meaning and that it can change conditions for people in real and important ways. And I think that one of the aspects of that is that the template that we have been given for what paradigm shift or what revolution looks like or what it means is fundamentally flawed, because of course that template has been given to us by the same people who are presumably in trying to put over this grand deception about life itself. And that template is one that it sounds like is the one that you're mocking there with the grand uprising and everyone, you know, will take charge of the situation or something like that. I think that that template is flawed because the type of revolution that I see is not that type of revolution. It's not pitchforks at the White House. It is more of the change in personal consciousness that affects the way that people live their lives. And that is the type of change that can happen on an individual basis for each individual person who encounters and understands that message, which in its overall effect will take down that overall consensus that behind which the political reality is constructed. So,
see, I'm with you right up to the end. See, and I've heard you articulate that beautifully on your show, and I'm with you right up to the end, because here is my point. The kind of transformation that I talk about, the tipping point that I talk about on the show, is available to everyone right now. So I am a different person from doing Skeptico. I am a different person in my beliefs across the board. I'm a different person in my orientation towards what my life means relative to the universe, relative to anything that's happened before and anything different. I don't feel a need to kind of share that because I think that's my personal mission. But I don't think anyone who, I think truth, and in the same way that you're talking about, I think taking a step down that path transforms you. I think the information that you're talking about on your show is transformative to people in ways that is irrespective of what political actions they take. So I think someone can listen to the Corbett Report, not be a registered voter, and then listen to the Corbett Report, still not be a registered voter, still not do anything political, but have a new appreciation, a new worldview that enriches their lives because it makes them more free from the misinformation and the control mechanisms that they're under. And that's all it has to be. I don't think we need that next step that you're talking about. And from a skeptical perspective, we definitely don't need that next step. The all the transformation and all the change that you could possibly want is available to you just by that little voice inside your head and what you do with it.
That's interesting. I don't think that the disagreement there is so great as you paint it, because I don't believe that what I talk about is the end result of that step of personal transformation of consciousness is another step. I think that's the result of that step that each individual is taking right now. And that's why the focus on my work, increasingly so in recent years, has been more on personal self-sufficiency and the types of things that people can do to affect their own lives, firstly and foremostly, rather than dwelling on these geopolitical narratives that I fully admit most people can't do really anything fundamentally about. So I think we are in agreement on certain aspects of this, although perhaps the motivation for why we do what we do is coming from a slightly different place. But let me say this then. I have to applaud the finale of your book, and spoiler, I'll reveal the the very end, in which you say, "I've avoided conclusions and advice in this book because I don't have much to offer except this: follow the data wherever it leads. That's what I'm going to do." That's a very brave way of ending a book like this, because people are expecting some kind of grand summation and, you know, this is what, where you can take this and this is what you will do with this. Whereas that is a very open-ended and much less popular way to end a book, but I think one that is integral to sort of the message of what you're doing. So let me applaud you for that and ask you if you did have any sort of trepidation about putting that down as the final summation of this book.
No, because ultimately, and that's where I guess we do live in kind of different worlds. The skeptical world and the path that I've been on ultimately is one of the words are not convenient and don't fit, but it's really spiritual transformation. It's what all the great sages and wisdom traditions throughout time have talked about, and that is, there is more to this world and this life than what appears. And it's not what's in the Bible, and it's not, well, maybe it's a part of what's in the Bible. Maybe it's a part of many great wisdom traditions where the thread runs in the same direction. So that kind of transformation is really outside the realm of geopolitical and really material interests in general. So that's where I'm going. And in that respect, I'm extremely reluctant to give advice. And I think everyone has to seek that out themselves. But I think when I'm so grateful for this opportunity to talk to you and to be on your show, because that is the parallel that I see. I see the opening up that someone can go through from the Corbett Report, from an honest, sincere ability to look at the data and say, wow, my fundamental assumptions that I've lived on my life on are flawed. I need to change direction. That is so brave. And I see so few people that are really willing to do that. And the people who are willing to do that and are willing to open up to that, I think if they look over in this direction that I'm talking about and they say, okay, who am I really? What is the best evidence for who I am, why I'm here? I think there's a whole bunch of mysteries to kind of unravel over there that can be very enriching.
There absolutely are. And I think there's many other points of this that we could get into and some more of the nuance of this discussion, but perhaps we'll leave things there for now. I'm sure we have provoked some sort of response amongst probably every single listener to this conversation so far. Some positive, I'm sure some negative, but at the very least, hopefully we've expanded some people's conceptions of what this work can do and what the possibilities of real consciousness transformation are. And in that regard, hopefully we've made them at least a little bit interested in Skeptico, the podcast, and the book, Why Science is Wrong About Almost Everything. And again, the Skeptico podcast is available at skeptiko.com. But tell people about how they can get a copy of the book.
The usual places, just Google Why Science is Wrong and it'll come right up. You can go to the website or get it in all the places. And you know, it's been great fun. I do hope anyone checks it out who's interested. Give a listen to Skeptico. And I'm not opposed to people who oppose me. I love it. I learn from disagreeing and you know, I love your pointed questions and your challenging me on things. I think that's terrific, and I appreciate that kind of dialogue.
Well, I appreciate you engaging in that dialogue, so hopefully it can continue in the future, but we'll leave it there for now. Alex Sekouris, thank you again for your time on today's podcast.
It's been my pleasure, James.